An introduction to the five aggregates. Form is like a large lump of foam. Feeling is like a water bubble. Perception is like a mirage. Formations are like a banana tree. Consciousness is like a magician. Upon investigating, they would appear empty, void, and without substance. Him I call a noble one, who even in this existence realizes the end of dukkha, who has laid down the burden of the aggregates, and who is free from moral defilements. The main focus of this section will be the five aggregates. Let's start by asking, what are the five aggregates? In short, the five aggregates are the materiality aggregate, feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, volitional formations aggregate, and consciousness aggregate. In this world, there are two types of truth or reality. They are, one, conventional truth, and two, ultimate truth. Conventional truth refers to ordinary concepts such as tree, house, table, man, woman, you, me, person, body, being, etc. Such concepts are closely linked to our language, culture, and conditioning. Ultimate truth means something which exists by reason of its own intrinsic nature. The five aggregates are ultimate truth and are the object of Vipassana meditation. The difference between conventional truth and ultimate truth can be made clear by quoting a conversation between King Milinda and Arahant Nagasena. King Milinda was a very good and famous debater, and he had the impression that the Buddha's teachings were inferior because no Buddhist monks had ever been able to defeat him in debate. One day, an elderly Mahatera, who was an Arahant, requested Arahant Nagasena to have a debate with King Milinda. So King Milinda came to Arahant Nagasena's monastery and, after paying respect to him, asked, "Venerable sir, how do your monks address you?" Venerable Nagasena replied, "My fellow monks address me as Nagasena, but Nagasena is not real. It does not exist at the level of ultimate truth." King Milinda seized the chance. "You said Nagasena does not exist. If that is the case, then who are you? Who is the one that sits in front of me, receives my bow, receives my homage, and receives my offerings of the four requisites?" Arahant Nagasena replied with a question, "King, how did you come to this temple?" King Milinda replied that he had come in a chariot. Arahant Nagasena continued, "Well then, please show me your chariot. Is the horse that pulls the chariot, or the wheel of the chariot, or the carriage of the chariot, or the axle of the chariot?" King Milinda replied, "No, the horse is not the chariot, neither is the wheel, carriage, nor axle the chariot." Arahant Nagasena continued, "King, only just now you said you came here in a chariot, and yet you couldn't give me a clear answer as to what a chariot is." King Milinda replied, "A chariot is made up of all the parts that you have mentioned. The combination of these parts forms a chariot." Then Venerable Nagasena said, "Very good, Your Highness. The way you understand the chariot is the way you should understand me. In the same way as the chariot does not exist in ultimate reality, so too Nagasena does not exist as a self. What actually exists is only the five aggregates. Nagasena is just the combination of the materiality aggregate, the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the formations aggregate, and the consciousness aggregate." The essence of this conversation between King Milinda and Venerable Nagasena is simply to answer the question, what makes up the self? Who am I, and what is my real self? Now you should be able to answer the question of what makes up the self. The self is only a conventional truth. Penetrating the conventional truth with wisdom, one understands that the self is the combination of the five aggregates. We are living in conventional truth. Without relying on conventional truth, everything would be out of order. Conventional truth makes communication possible, and without it, the world cannot function. However, one should not be shackled in the world of conventional truth, but go beyond it. This is because only the penetration of ultimate truth can liberate us from ignorance and allow us to attain true and lasting happiness. Now let me ask you a second question. Why do we need to understand the five aggregates? We need to understand them because the five aggregates are the noble truth of suffering. The entire teaching of the Buddha is centered on the four noble truths, and the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering, is the five aggregates subject to clinging. Without understanding the five aggregates subject to clinging, we cannot understand the noble truth of suffering, and if we do not understand the truth of suffering, how can we expect to get rid of it? Suffering is called dukkha in Pali. Dukkha is a compound word consisting of two syllables, du, which means bad, and kam, which means void of happiness. So dukkha is bad. Why is it so? This is because it is void of happiness. Dukkha also implies difficult to endure, owing to impermanence and emptiness. Dukkha can be explained in three ways. One, dukkha is ordinary suffering, dukkha-dukkha. Two, dukkha owing to change, viparinama-dukkha. And three, dukkha as a conditional state, sankhara-dukkha. One, dukkha-dukkha refers to what most of us understand as ordinary suffering. It is the most obvious kind of suffering, that which is related to gross mental and physical pain. This body brings a lot of suffering if you are mindful enough to observe it. For example, if you are practicing sitting meditation for half an hour, pain will probably arise somewhere in the body. If you find the pain is too much to endure, you will need to change your posture. In a short time, another pain will arise in another part of your body. In order to continue your sitting meditation, you will need to keep changing your posture to cope with the pain. This is the physical aspect of dukkha-dukkha. After 1 hour of sitting, you may decide to get up and practice walking meditation. However, after walking for some time, you may also feel discomfort. If you engage in either practice continuously for 1 or 2 hours, the body will reveal to you various aches and pains, all of which are manifestations of dukkha-dukkha. Then you may decide to lie down. After lying down for a long time, you will also feel that lying down is actually not comfortable. Then you may decide to sit down again. No matter what the posture, if you maintain it long enough, the suffering nature of the physical body will invariably be revealed. Why is it that in your ordinary life you do not clearly see dukkha inherent in the body as you do during a meditation retreat? It is because we keep on changing postures. When there is even a little discomfort, we unconsciously change our posture, which makes the bodily pain disappear. During meditation, however, we are advised to keep the same posture without moving, and then the suffering nature of the physical body is revealed. This type of suffering is one aspect of what we call dukkha-dukkha. 2. Viparinama-dukkha is suffering owing to change. It mainly refers to the change of pleasant feeling. The only unchanging thing in this world is change itself. Both mind and body are constantly changing, the main difference being that the mental aggregates change even faster than the material aggregate. For example, you may experience pleasant feelings at this moment because you had a good experience during your morning meditation, and a brilliant light appeared owing to deep concentration. You feel good and your faith increases. As a result, you believe that achieving jhana is at hand. You begin the next sitting with great effort and expectation. However, this time, not only is there no light, but your mind is also burdened with restlessness due to excessive effort. Very quickly, your pleasant feelings change to unpleasant feelings, and you end up feeling frustrated. You are now experiencing a kind of suffering that arises due to your attachment to the previous pleasant experience. When we cling to a happy state and that state changes, we feel suffering in its place because of our attachment to that happiness. This is what we call suffering owing to change, viparinama dukkha. 3. Sankhara dukkha is suffering due to the changing nature of all conditioned existence. Sometimes you feel that your body is beyond your control. It ages and you become sick. Your emotions, happiness, and sorrow are also beyond your control. Whatever change takes place in the body and mind is beyond your control because the change is produced by causes which are also beyond your control. When the weather is too hot, you suffer, so you may go into an air-conditioned room. After some time, you feel the temperature has become too cold for you, and this in turn is another type of suffering. In fact, there is not a single thing in the universe over which you have absolute control, since all conditioned things are in a state of constant change. That which is beyond your control causes fear and suffering. At times, unable to cope with the hardships of life patiently without complaint, you feel disenchanted with your life. You may wish that you could just stop living, but somehow life keeps pushing you on. Since the causes that led you to rebirth as a human being are not yet exhausted, you must bear the burden patiently. This is what we call suffering due to conditions, sankhara dukkha. All this dukkha, regardless of whether it is dukkha dukkha, viparinama dukkha, or sankhara dukkha, comes from the five aggregates of clinging. The dukkha dukkha arises based on clinging to the materiality aggregate. The viparinama dukkha arises based on clinging to the mental aggregates, and the sankhara dukkha arises based on clinging to all the aggregates. That is why the five aggregates of clinging are called the noble truth of suffering, dukkha, araya, sakka. Let's go back to the second question. Why should we understand the five aggregates? We should understand them because these five aggregates are the objects of identity, view, and clinging. We have a body and we identify our body as I. Without having a body, how could we possibly identify it as I? Thus, the materiality aggregate becomes the object of identity view. We also cling to the body as mine with craving. And when we cling to the body as mine, we also cling to the view that we are the body. In fact, we cling to this identity view as if our life depended on it. And in a way, it does. Thus, a vicious cycle is set in motion. Body begets view, and view begets body. The same is true of the other four aggregates: feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. Whenever we experience a pleasant feeling, we identify the pleasant feeling as I. We take this pleasant feeling as our self. When our eyes see something, we say, "Oh, I see." When the ears hear something, we say, "I hear, I hear." What actually happens during the hearing process is that sound impinges on the ear sensitivity, and because of this contact, hearing consciousness arises. This is the actual process, but without seeing this process clearly, we identify it as ourself hearing a sound. In the same way, when we eat something, the food touches the tongue sensitivity, and due to this contact, tongue consciousness arises, knowing the taste. But without understanding this process, we immediately identify it as ourself tasting the food. Thus, without seeing clearly, we grasp everything seen, heard, smelled, tasted, and sensed as ourself. Therefore, identity view comes about. After listening to the following discourse, Venerable Ananda realized the Dharma and became a stream enterer. In this discourse, it was said to the Venerable Ananda, "It is by clinging that the notion I am occurs, not without it." And by clinging to what does the notion of I am occur? What do you think? It is by clinging to the five aggregates that the notion I am occurs. Or if we say it is by clinging to the body and mind, we are simply referring to the ultimate reality of the five aggregates by using a conventional truth. It is by clinging to our body and mind that the notion I am occurs. The discourse then proceeds to give a simile of a young woman, fond of wearing ornaments, who is standing in front of a mirror. Before the mirror, she will look at her facial image with clinging, not without clinging. So there the notion of I am occurs because of clinging. Clinging to what? It is clinging to the five aggregates. The discourse continues, "Is this materiality aggregate impermanent or permanent?" And Venerable Ananda replies, impermanent, Venerable Sir. Theoretically, we know the body is impermanent, but when physical pain arises and we react with aversion to our physical pain, it is an indication that we have already forgotten about impermanence. When we feel good physically and there is an absence of pain, we also forget that happiness of the body is impermanent. We cling to physical happiness. So when physical happiness goes away, we suffer, because we grasp after it, not wanting it to go away. Why are we so forgetful? I believe it is because the perception of impermanence is not deeply imprinted in our mind. Clear perception of impermanence is the proximate cause for strong mindfulness. When the perception of impermanence is strong, the mindfulness of impermanence will also be strong. You should investigate your own body to see if it's actually impermanent. Do not believe this just because the Buddha said it. Keep your attention on your body with complete mindfulness. From the moment you wake up, begin to observe your body. Initially, you may feel groggy. Then after eating, continue to pay attention to your body. You will see that the state of your body has changed. With or without food, the body exhibits different states. When the mind is happy, the body feels light and robust. When the mind is sad, the body tends to feel heavy and rigid. If you continue to observe your body, you will see how your body changes according to the state of your mind. During sitting meditation, when the mind is well concentrated on the meditation object, the body is erect and quiet. The concentrated mind holds the posture. However, when the mind is restless, the body tends to move here and there. Thus, our body changes depending on food and the state of the mind. Since the body is constantly changing depending on the causes, how can then we posit a permanent self that is identical to the body? The materiality aggregate is indeed impermanent and without a self. Similarly, Venerable Ananda was asked about the feeling aggregates. Is the feeling aggregate impermanent or permanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir, replied Venerable Ananda. The feeling aggregate changes almost every moment. For example, when your eyes see your loved one, pleasant feelings arise. If this experience is followed by seeing an enemy, unpleasant feelings will follow. When the ears hear abusive words, unpleasant feelings arise. If this is followed by praise, the unpleasant feelings change to pleasant. When your tongue tastes food that you like, pleasant feelings arise, and similarly, when your tongue tastes food that you do not like, unpleasant feelings arise. So feeling is not only impermanent, but also conditioned by external factors. Next, Venerable Ananda was asked about the perception aggregate. Is the perception aggregate impermanent or permanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir, said Venerable Ananda. Our perception, like our feeling, keeps changing moment by moment. What you perceive now may be completely different from what you had previously perceived. For example, previously you may have perceived that money brings happiness. Due to that perception, you place a high value on money and try hard to accumulate more and more. As life goes on and you become old and sick, you realize that money cannot bring you lasting happiness. That's why you've come here to practice the Dharma, in order to pursue true happiness, which is faultless and unconditioned. Then Venerable Ananda was asked about the formations aggregate. Is the formations aggregate impermanent or permanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir, said Venerable Ananda. The formations aggregate includes wholesome and unwholesome mental factors such as anger, jealousy, generosity, happiness, restlessness, concentration, wisdom, etc. Your desire and effort to meditate also change. At one time, you may practice with a great sense of urgency. At another time, you may not want to sit at all. In the course of practice, you are sometimes mindful and sometimes not. When your concentration is good, you can sit for a long time without moving. At other times, your mind may be obsessed by hindrances, and you may feel like jumping up from the seat. There seems to be no consistency in the mind. This is the way things are. Lastly, Venerable Ananda was asked about the consciousness aggregate. Is the consciousness aggregate impermanent or permanent? Venerable Ananda replied, impermanent, Venerable Sir. There are six types of consciousness: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness. Each consciousness takes its respective object, form for the eye, sound for the ear, odor for the nose, taste for the tongue, touch for the body, and mental objects for the mind. When you walk into a restaurant, eye consciousness sees the form of various dishes displayed, ear consciousness hears the waiter greeting you, nose consciousness smells the aroma of the food, tongue consciousness tastes the deliciousness of the food, body consciousness senses the softness of the seat, and mind consciousness lingers on the pleasant and unpleasant feelings that arise in conjunction with the other consciousnesses. When you have finished eating, if the overall impression or perception from the various sense doors is pleasant feeling, you may decide to come to the restaurant again, volitional formations, and your consciousness is privy to that decision. Considering that consciousness can only take one object at a time, the flow of consciousness from one object to the other is so rapid that these different sense impressions seem to merge together into a single uniform presentation, similar to the rapid display of individual frames on a movie screen. The consciousness is rising and ceasing at every moment in succession. Only when the mind is concentrated are we able to see the individual frames of our sense door consciousness arising and passing away, one after the other, with such incredible speed. Investigating these five aggregates, we find them constantly changing, one state giving way to the next. Their very nature is to change. Venerable Ananda was asked to investigate these five aggregates to see their inherent nature of arising and passing away. He was asked, "Is what is impermanent happiness or suffering?" To this, Venerable Ananda answered, "Suffering. We all agree that what is impermanent cannot bring happiness. Therefore, what is impermanent is also dukkha." Ananda was further asked, "Is what is impermanent suffering, subject to change and destruction, fit to be regarded as I, me, and mine?" "No, Venerable Sir," answered Venerable Ananda. "What is impermanent and subject to suffering cannot be regarded as a self. Thus, the five aggregates are not a self. If they are not a self, what are they? They are merely an ongoing process of cause and effect, nothing substantial, but a series of causal relationships." In this discourse, an important question is posed that calls for our investigation. How does the notion of I am occur? Let's summarize the reasons for studying the five aggregates. 1, because the five aggregates are the noble truth of suffering. 2, because the five aggregates are the objects from which identity view and clinging spring. 3, because the five aggregates are the objects of investigation for gaining insight. If one keeps on investigating the nature of the five aggregates with wisdom, one will eventually see that these five aggregates are arising and passing away continuously. As a result, one becomes disenchanted with the aggregates. Thus disenchanted, it becomes possible for one to let go of clinging to the five aggregates. However, at present, we are still attached to our body and mind. Why is this so? It's because we have not yet seen the damage they can cause. We are just like a child who sees fireworks for the first time, becomes fascinated by the display, and develops an attachment to it. One day, however, he touches one of the fireworks and gets burnt. He begins to realize that fireworks are not only beautiful but also dangerous. They are danger in disguise. He knows if he holds on to one of the fireworks, he may get seriously burned. For the sake of his safety and happiness, he starts to keep at a distance from the fireworks. He has learned to let go of his attachment to fireworks. Now he looks at the fireworks dispassionately. We are in a similar position to that child. Although we have been told many times that this body and mind are suffering, dukkha, we still cling to them. We need to be burned in order to let go of our clinging. So how can we see the danger of the mind and the body? It is only through directly experiencing the constantly arising and ceasing of the mind and body that their danger is revealed. This requires repeated mindfulness to the extent necessary for insight to arise, and this is the goal of Vipassana practice. It is important for you to know the goal when you come to practice meditation, but this doesn't mean that you attach to the goal. Knowing the goal of the practice and attaching to the goal are two very different things. You know clearly the goal, but in the course of the practice, you don't need to think about it. The practice is not just about wanting to sit down and see arising and passing away of the body and mind. If this is so, your meditation will end up in suffering owing to expectation. In this practice, the Dharma will only reveal itself when one's insight is mature. If your insight is not matured enough to see the rapid arising and passing away, you just have to continue practicing. Patience leads to the achieving of the goal. The process of practicing Vipassana can be compared to a hen hatching eggs. The hen has to sit on top of the eggs and make sure the eggs are well covered and nurtured. Only then will the chicks break through the shell and hatch properly. Similarly, you must make sure your practice is done properly and continuously. The progress will take its own natural course. You need to remember that the progress of the practice, the removal of the defilements such as covetousness, jealousy, selfishness, anger, lust, etc., takes a long time. It may take 5 years, 10 years, 20 years before you can see that the defilements have worn away. Do not expect to see immediate results. Despite this, you must have the confidence that as long as you are practicing, you will progress. Be delighted when seeing minor defilements wear away day after day. This practice can be compared to the experience of a carpenter looking at the handle of the axe that he works with every day. He only sees the impression of his thumbs. He does not know so much of the handle of this axe has worn away today, so much yesterday, so much earlier. But when it is worn away, the knowledge occurs that it has worn away. So it is with the practice. Now a look at the five aggregates in detail. The materiality aggregate. The materiality aggregate in Pali is called rupakanda. Rupa is derived from the word rupati, which means to be deformed, disturbed, oppressed, and broken. All kinds of states that have the characteristics of being attacked or deformed come under the materiality aggregate. The materiality aggregate is also the base for all diseases. The meaning of rupa is the continuous change of materiality, oppressed and disturbed by adverse physical conditions. Rupa consists of the four great elements, earth element, fire element, water element, and wind element. Dependent upon these four elements, there are 24 types of derived materiality, for example, eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body sensitivity, color, smell, taste, nutriment, etc. These are called derived materiality because they are derived from the four great elements. There are four causes for the arising of the four great elements, karma, consciousness, nutriment, and temperament. Karma means both our past and present action, and the present four elements are a product of past karma. Take our digestive fire in the stomach as an example. This digestive fire is part of the fire element, which is one of the four elements. Owing to some unwholesome past karma, the four elements which are the products of that karma may have a deficient fire element in a particular case. The deficiency of the fire element causes weak digestive fire in the stomach, and this can affect a person's health. This is how karma can impact the four great elements. The four great elements are also produced by consciousness, chitta-rupa. For example, when you have the intention to walk, your intention produces the four elements, especially the wind element that pushes your body to go forward. Wholesome and unwholesome mental states also affect the elements of the body. If your mind is in a wholesome state, such as radiating love and compassion for all beings, then the wholesome mental state produces wholesome four elements, which energize your body. But if your mind is in an unwholesome state, for example, if it is associated with hatred, then that hatred mind state produces four elements, especially the fire element in excess in your body. The excessive fire element burns your body. Due to the excessive fire element, the wind element becomes excessive too. The wind element pushes your body, and your whole body shivers because of anger. You can experience this yourself. This is how the mind state affects the four elements in the body. With this understanding, for the sake of our health, we should always cultivate wholesome mental states to ensure that good health. The food you eat also affects the four elements in the body. If you consume wholesome foods, it produces healthy four elements that make your body healthy and strong. On the other hand, if you eat junk food, this unhealthy food produces unhealthy four elements that affect your health. The last cause for the arising of the four elements in the body is temperature. The external and internal temperatures affect the four elements in the body. For example, if the weather is very hot, the whole body becomes fiery and sweats. If the weather is too cold, the body becomes inactive and the skin cracks. As for the internal temperature, excessive intake of chili peppers makes the body very hot. On the other hand, the intake of ice cream cools down the temperature of the body. From here, you can clearly see that the body, which is merely the effect, reacts according to the adverse causes of past karma, consciousness, nutriment, and temperature. The body is just a group of effects produced by causes. Therefore, the body is conditioned. Even though this is a theoretical understanding, it temporarily helps you to remove the wrong view of body as a permanent self, or self as being in the body. The feeling aggregate. Feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness are mental aggregates. There are three ways to study them, according to their characteristics, functions, and manifestations. The characteristic of feeling is to be felt. The function of feeling is to experience the desirable or undesirable aspect of the object. For example, during the eating process, when the favorable food touches your tongue sensitivity and you feel pleasure, it is not you who feels pleasure. In your mental stream, there is one mental factor called feeling, and this mental factor at that moment performs its function of experiencing and enjoying the desirable aspect of the taste. Therefore, whenever you enjoy something agreeable, it is the mental factor of feeling that makes you feel pleasure. You must bear in mind that the mental factor of feeling enjoys the taste and gives you a pleasant experience. The mental factor of feeling is not I, not he, not she, and not a person. The function of the mental factor of feeling is just to experience the object. Each object has its desirable or undesirable aspect. Who experiences it? Feeling experiences it. When you look at your loved ones at that moment, feeling performs its function of experiencing the lovable aspect of your loved one, and the manifestation of feeling is to make the associated mental states of perception, formations, and consciousness happy. The body also feels happy. Therefore, you feel good when looking at your loved ones. On the other hand, if your eyes see an enemy, unpleasant feelings arise and make the associated mental states and body unhappy. That's all. If you can understand how feeling plays its role, then you will not misperceive feeling as a self. There are three types of feeling: pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and neutral feeling. Where do these feelings come from? They come from contact or impingement. There are six types of contact. When the eyes see a visible object, that is called eye contact. According to dependent origination, when there is eye contact, dependent on that contact, feeling arises. Since there is eye contact, there must be one type of feeling born from eye contact. When sound impinges on the ear sensitivity, this impingement is called ear contact. When there's ear contact, there must be one type of feeling born from ear contact. The same goes for the other sense contacts. When fragrant odor touches the nose sensitivity, dependent on the nose contact, pleasant feeling born from nose contact arises. Similarly, when a very bitter food touches your tongue sensitivity, owing to this tongue contact, there arises unpleasant feeling, experiencing the undesirable aspect of the taste. Likewise, when the body touches soft silk due to this bodily contact, there arises pleasant feeling. When you think of something pleasurable, then pleasant feeling arises due to mind contact. When you think of something not pleasurable, unpleasant feeling arises. The neutral feeling arises when the contacts with the six sense objects are neutral. Therefore, we have pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feelings with regard to each contact. Since there are six contacts, there are 18 types of feelings. When one practices contemplation of feelings, these 18 types of feelings are the object of one's contemplation. If we miss contemplating the feeling, for example, the pleasant feeling that arises from eating, attachment or craving follows the pleasant feeling. According to the formula of dependent origination and through our own practical experience, depending on pleasant feeling, craving arises. Suppose we experience a very pleasant feeling when tasting a piece of chocolate cake, and depending on this pleasant feeling, we reach out with our hand to grasp another piece. This is a sign of craving, is it not? We will also identify feelings as I or myself and give in to identity view. In the practice to attain stream enterer, we have to get rid of identity view by contemplating feeling as feeling. Therefore, if we are not mindful of pleasant feeling, two defilements, craving and identity view, will follow. This understanding reminds us to be contemplative. The six contacts of eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind are always open, except when we fall asleep. Since these six contacts are always there, it means these six types of feelings are also always present. Therefore, feeling is always there to be observed. If there is no pleasant or unpleasant feeling, there will be a neutral feeling. Just observe the neutral feeling and see how it changes. The perception aggregate. The characteristic of perception is that it perceives the quality of an object. Each object has its own quality. The function of perception is that it makes a sign regarding those qualities to enable recognition of the object. For example, how do you recognize a bird flying in the sky? You recognize it from its two wings, which are a sign or a characteristic of a bird that has been imprinted on your mind. The manifestation of perception is the action of interpreting one's experience by means of signs one has observed. We always perceive in a distorted way. Just like the blind man who touches the elephant, the blind man cannot see the elephant as a whole. If he touches one part of the elephant, such as the leg, he may conclude that the elephant is like a pillar. This is the sign which the blind man misapprehends and mistakenly imprints in his memory. This sign is a distorted sign, which is not in accordance with the truth. The elephant's leg is only one part of the elephant. It is not the totality or the complete picture of the elephant. Many of us, on seeing a coil of rope at night, would perceive it to be a snake and get frightened. This is called perverted or distorted perception. Perception perceives what is wrong as right, or vice versa. When can we see a rope as rope? Only when there is light. Under the influence of ignorance, the darkness of the mind, we perceive the five aggregates as permanent, happiness, and self. This is similar to the situation when we see a coil of rope and mistake it for a snake. When wisdom arises, we clearly see the true nature of the five aggregates. Perception is grouped under the five aggregates because of its importance. Thought and view follow what one perceives. The Buddha repeatedly said that all formations are impermanent, but we still perceive otherwise owing to the deep imprint of distorted perception in life after life. Once the phenomenon is wrongly perceived, it takes great effort and a long time to correct it. That's why no matter how many times we have been taught that all things are impermanent, 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 we still forget. Look at our own experiences. Take feeling as an example. Since our birth until now, our feelings have changed constantly from pleasant to unpleasant or from unpleasant to neutral and vice versa. Before you were married, you felt excited about your beloved. After marriage, the feelings may not be as pleasant as before. Sometimes you may even harbor bad feelings toward your spouse. You experience the instability of feelings as life unfolds. But why is your perception of impermanence still shaky? This is caused by latent ignorance and the failure to contemplate impermanence when actually experiencing change. Every time your feelings change, if you could contemplate them accordingly, then the perception of impermanence will be enhanced. through the reinforcement, it becomes habit. As contemplating impermanence becomes a mental habit, we will look upon happiness and sorrow as passing clouds in the sky. Whatever arises, just contemplate arising and passing away repeatedly until your mindset matches this reality of impermanence. Then nothing will move you. You will not be disturbed by any circumstances. Whatever happens to you, whether it be praise or blame, fame or defame, gain or loss, happiness or suffering, you remain unmoved because you know that all will change. So why attach? Happiness arises and passes away. Sorrow arises and passes away. Our prosperity may not last long, and that newly bought Mercedes may get banged. So why attach? It is better to take impermanence as your refuge. If the perception of impermanence is strong in the mindset, then one can maintain equanimity all the time. One single contemplation of impermanence frees oneself from grasping in that moment. Practice moment to moment, day after day, year after year, until there comes a day when the mind is completely free from clinging to anything whatsoever. Then you have achieved freedom of the heart. The formations aggregate. The characteristic of formations is forming, fabricating, or constructing. The Buddha said, "They form the form, bhikkhus. This is why they are called formations." According to the Abhidhamma, excluding feeling and perception, the rest of the 50 mental factors are termed as formations. These mental factors include craving, jealousy, mindfulness, effort, concentration, avarice, sloth and torpor, restlessness, faith, tranquility, desire, determination, doubt, wisdom, hatred, delusion, etc. The function of formations is to accumulate karma, whether it is through bodily, verbal, or mental action. Whatever actions one performs, whether they are rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion, or non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion, they are termed karma. Once karma is performed, it leaves behind potency, or an energy that can produce effect. Karma can be likened to a seed. When you throw a seed onto the ground, it has the potential to sprout. Similarly, whatever action we do has the potency to produce an effect. It is called karmic potency, a phenomenon which cannot be seen by the eye. The manifestation of formations occurs as a result of one's intervening or controlling due to becoming interested in an object. For example, when you are mindful of your breath, it is a formation because your mind is interested in this breath. You accumulate karma, which in this case is good karma. Practicing samatha is always good karma, since the mind is absorbed in a pure object. However, this type of karma prolongs your life in the round of rebirths if you stop short and do not proceed to insight. Vipassana is different. In vipassana practice, whatever object arises, you contemplate impermanence, suffering, and non-self. The mind does not become interested or engaged. Instead, the mind turns away from engaging in that object. This turning away from the object or non-clinging cuts short the round of rebirths. We have mundane activity and supramundane activity. In mundane activity, volition is the leader because it accumulates karma. In supramundane activity, wisdom is the leader because wisdom is like a sword that cuts off the defilements that produce rebirth. The condition for the arising of the feeling, perception, and formations aggregates is contact. The consciousness aggregate. Consciousness has the characteristic of knowing an object. The function of consciousness is to be the forerunner of mental factors, although they arise together. The manifestation of consciousness occurs as a continuity of process rather than as an independent being experiencing the phenomena. For example, while watching a TV program, you may eat ice cream and rock your legs. There are several actions here. Eye consciousness arises on seeing the form of the screen. Ear consciousness arises on hearing the sound. Tongue consciousness arises on tasting the ice cream. Nose consciousness arises on smelling the fragrance of the ice cream. Body consciousness arises on sensing the shake of the legs. And mind consciousness interprets what the program shows. These six consciousnesses arise one after another in succession, not all at once. but we think they arise all at once because we fail to see the rapid arising and passing away of each discrete consciousness. In a snap of the fingers, millions of consciousnesses arise and pass away. Therefore, as we watch TV, different consciousnesses arise one after another in rapid succession. Unable to understand the actual process, we conclude seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing, and thinking as myself. We wrongly think, I am eye consciousness, I am ear consciousness, I am mind consciousness. We think, these six consciousnesses are mine. The six consciousnesses arise one after another as a continuity of process, but we think it is a single continuous consciousness we identify as I that is experiencing the watching of the TV program. That's why the Buddha said consciousness is like a magician deceiving us. A magician can create something unreal and we believe it. Consciousness is dependently arisen. Consciousness is named by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent on the eye and forms, it is reckoned as eye consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the ear and sounds, it is reckoned as ear consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the nose and odors, it is reckoned as nose consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the tongue and flavors, it is reckoned as tongue consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the body and tangibles, it is reckoned as body consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the mind and mind objects, it is reckoned as mind consciousness. In summary, we have six types of consciousness: eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. For each consciousness to arise, its conditional factors must be fulfilled. For example, for eye consciousness to arise, four factors are needed: eye sensitivity, light, attention, and form. When the cause of seeing is fulfilled, the effect of seeing arises. It is the same for the other types of consciousness. None of the consciousnesses is I, he, she, or a person. This is the correct view. The gratification of the five aggregates. The gratification of the materiality aggregate. The form that is derived from the primary elements gives rise to excitement, enjoyment, satisfaction, and brings gratification to the eyes. For example, when one has nothing to do at home, there is a tendency to switch on the TV. That's because the various forms projected by the TV satisfy the eyes. This is enjoyment of the eyes. How about sound? Some people are fond of music, classical, rock and roll, etc. Others like to hear sweet and pleasing talk, such as praise from other people, although sometimes it may not be true. Music and pleasant words give satisfaction, enjoyment, and excitement to the ears. The nose likes a fragrant odor, and this makes the Paris fragrances sell well in the world. A fragrant odor gratifies the nose and gladdens the mind. The same is true of taste. Taste is also a derived materiality. Various tastes excite the taste buds. If we eat the same type of food every day, very soon we will get bored. That's because just one type of taste is not able to satisfy the tongue. The variety of foods gives rise to different excitement, enjoyment, and satisfaction for the tongue, and various restaurants are established to satisfy our needs. The soft touch, the touch of fine cloth, or the touch of one's partner gives rise to excitement and brings gratification to the body. It is precisely owing to this feeling of ecstasy generated from the touch of one's partner that craving arises again and again. In short, the pleasure and joy that arise dependent on the five internal bases and their respective five external objects are the gratification of the materiality aggregate. The gratification of the feeling aggregate. The feeling aggregate, especially pleasant feeling, gives more enjoyment than the materiality aggregate. Some people get addicted to alcohol, drugs, morphine, and other addictive substances not because of their taste, but because these things stimulate a strong pleasant feeling. These people are addicted to the pleasant feeling that the drugs provide. This pleasant feeling thrills both mind and body. So this explains the enjoyment, gratification, and excitement of the feeling aggregate. The gratification of the perception aggregate. We always perceive all formations as permanent, happiness, and self. This distorted perception makes the mind happy. Most people perceive worldly life as full of happiness. Being surrounded by our loved ones is joyful. Enjoying the wealth one gains is happiness. Such a way of perceiving things satisfies us, and we cannot bear to renounce everything and become monks or nuns. The perception of self satisfies the majority. Few can bear to perceive the mind and body as not a self. We do not like to hear that our property and loved ones do not belong to us because the concepts of no self and no mine threaten our ego-cherishing attitude. The gratification of the formations aggregate. Craving, one of the mental factors among formations aggregate, finds great enjoyment in sensual pleasure. Craving has the characteristic of grasping the sensual object. Its function is not to let go. The more one indulges in sensual pleasure, the more one's craving increases. We crave for existence, life after life. Many different good karmas are performed, which results in the continuation of life through many cycles of birth and death. The gratification of the consciousness aggregate. We are free to think whatever we want. Let us take, for example, the situation of a poor person. A poor person may not have a big house or a Mercedes, but he can dream of them. Nobody can stop him from dreaming. He might even think he is now the President of the United States. He indulges in his own thoughts, an action which satisfies him. His thoughts make him happy. Consciousness sustains life by being aware of some object. The very thought, "I am aware, thus still alive," gratifies the majority. This is called the gratification of the consciousness aggregate. As the five aggregates provide gratification and enjoyment, we cling or attach to them tenaciously. If the five aggregates did not provide enjoyment, satisfaction, or happiness, how could we cling to them? Owing to their gratification, we just keep running and revolving around form, around feeling, around perception, around volitional formations, and around consciousness. As we keep on running and revolving around them, we are not freed from form, not freed from feeling, not freed from perception, not freed from volitional formations, and not freed from consciousness. We are not freed from suffering. The gratification, enjoyment, and excitement of the five aggregates causes us to be blind to their dangers and faults. The Magandhaya Sutta narrates the following incident. A man was born blind and could not see colors, whether pink, green, black, or white. He could not see the moon, the sky, or the sun. However, one day he heard a man with good eyesight say, "How wonderful, good sir, is a white shirt or white cloth, beautiful, spotless, and clean." And this blind man went in search of something white, because after hearing somebody praising the white, spotless, clean shirt or cloth, he developed a strong attachment to this white shirt, although he could not see. One of his friends fooled him with a grimy and oil-stained cloth or rag and told him, "Here, my good friend, is a white shirt, beautiful, spotless, and clean." This blind man was so happy, he quickly took it and put it on. Having put it on, he felt gratified, satisfied, and happy. He went around showing off to other people. All of his friends laughed at him. One of his good friends told the blind man that he was wearing a grimy and oil-stained shirt, but the blind man still declared that he was wearing a white, clean, spotless shirt. His good friend thought that he should tell the blind man's mother. His mother tried to convince her son that he was wearing a grimy and oil-stained shirt. However, as her blind son was so attached to this shirt that he thought it was white, clean, and spotless, he did not believe her. His mother had no choice but to call for an eye doctor to cure his blindness. When he finally gained his eyesight and looked at his body, he found that it was not a white, clean, and spotless shirt that he cherished, but a grimy and oil-stained shirt. He exclaimed to himself, "Oh my gosh, how long have I been fooled, cheated, and deceived by that man in this grimy, oil-stained rag?" He quickly took it off and thought that the man who had fooled him should be killed. What is this oil-stained, grimy, and dirty shirt? It is none other than the five aggregates that we are all showing off to other people. We think, "How fit and beautiful is my body?" Instead, we should say, "How beautiful is my oil-stained rag?" Why did this blind man develop such strong attachment to this oil-stained and grimy shirt? Because he was blind and could not see, because of ignorance. Don't laugh at this blind man. We are in the same boat. Due to ignorance, we cannot see the fault of the five aggregates. We think that the five aggregates provide us with enjoyment, gratification, and happiness. We are just like the blind man who perceived the grimy shirt as beautiful, clean, and spotless. That's why we cling strongly to the five aggregates. Only when wisdom arises will ignorance give way. Then we start to see clearly the fault and the reality of the five aggregates. Then we will say, my gosh, how long have I been fooled, cheated, and deceived by this mind? One realizes that whatever in the world one might cling to, it is just materiality that one is clinging to. It is just feeling, just perception, just formations, and just consciousness that one is clinging to. It is precisely the gratification that the five aggregates stimulate that makes one cling to them. The danger of the five aggregates. Each coin has two sides. The five aggregates give gratification, but there is also danger in them. The danger of the five aggregates is that they are impermanent and subject to destruction. We may cling to our five aggregates, but once they change, the craving is no more satiated. Then we feel misery. For example, we cling to our body, delusively thinking that our body is healthy and strong. One day, when we go for a checkup and the diagnosis indicates that we have cancer, we won't be able to take joy in the body anymore. We will find that our previous perception of the body as a source of happiness now turns out to be the opposite. The body is giving us suffering now. This is the danger of the material aggregate. The mental aggregates of feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness change faster than the material aggregate. Within a single day, thousands of thoughts arise and pass away. Our cherished happiness soon leaves us and is replaced by sorrow. The praise we receive today becomes tomorrow's blame. The danger of the five aggregates is that they are impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is impermanent or suffering cannot be regarded as I, mine, or myself. The process of change is beyond our control. Therefore, the five aggregates are not self. What is not self and beyond our control cannot bring us lasting happiness. This is the danger of the five aggregates. The danger of the five aggregates could also be compared to a murderer who has disguised himself as a faithful servant of a rich man. The servant served the rich man very well, rising up before him, retiring after him, and doing whatever he wanted. He was agreeable in his conduct and endearing in his speech. Eventually, the rich man considered him a friend and placed trust in him. However, when the servant became aware that the rich man had placed trust in him, finding him alone, he took his life with a sharp knife. Our five aggregates are compared to a murderer living closely with us, though we may not recognize him. Our five aggregates serve us and please us well. We become very intimate with our five aggregates and place trust in our five aggregates. When attachment to the five aggregates grows strong, we will then be killed. The escape. We have spoken about the gratification and dangers of the five aggregates, but how do we escape from the dangers? The escape lies in removing the lust, the attachment, the craving, and the clinging to the five aggregates. To achieve this goal, we must see the five aggregates as they are, impermanent, suffering, and non-self. Without seeing their impermanent, suffering, and non-self nature, we are unable to remove our lust for them. We are just like that child who is fascinated by fireworks. Only when the child touches the fireworks and gets burned, will he know that fireworks are dangerous and he must let go of his clinging to them. The materiality aggregate. The Buddha compared the materiality aggregate to a lump of foam. He said, monks, suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. A man with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and this lump of foam would appear to him to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a lump of foam? So too, monks, whatever kind of form there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a monk inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it will appear to him to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a lump of foam? So if we inspect and investigate our body through four elements meditation, we will clearly see that the body is insubstantial. How do we practice the four elements meditation? We can scan the body. From the top of the head, slowly scan down to the feet. In whatever part we feel hardness, mentally we should note, earth element, earth element. If we feel hot somewhere, then mentally note, fire element, fire element. Move the awareness from the top of the head down to the soles of the feet repeatedly. If we feel softness in any part of the body, we should note, earth element, earth element. When awareness reaches the heart and we feel the heart pumping, then we contemplate it as wind element and note, wind element, wind element. Sometimes we might feel the tightness of the body. This is the water element. Contemplate water element, water element. As we move our awareness from the top of the head down to the feet, we will see various elements in our body. As concentration grows, we will come to a stage when we no longer feel the body, only the elements. The elements will manifest very fast, appearing and disappearing, up to the final stage when we will no longer see elements, but we will see only particles, billions of particles arising and passing away in the body. Some will see the body breaking up and falling apart. At this time, we will understand why the Buddha compared the materiality aggregate to foam. The body is like a lump of foam. For what substance could there be in this body? It is insubstantial. The feeling aggregate. The Buddha compared the feeling aggregate to a water bubble. Water bubbles arise and burst on the surface of the water constantly. We can observe this when it rains and the water falls into a pond. If we investigate our feelings from moment to moment, we will come to the conclusion that feelings are just like water bubbles, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a water bubble? It forms and perishes immediately. Similarly, our feelings, whether pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, come and go. The perception aggregate. The Buddha compared the perception aggregate to a mirage. During the hot season, sometimes we see that a mirage appears. We think it's real, but in fact it's unreal. Similarly, our perception, like a mirage, deceives us. It makes us think what is impermanent, suffering, and non-self is permanent happiness and with an enduring self. By constantly contemplating phenomena as they truly are, as impermanent, suffering, and non-self, we would be able to correct our distorted perception. The formations aggregate. The Buddha compared the formations aggregate to a banana tree. Take the case of a man who goes in search of heartwood and finds a banana tree. Wanting to get the heartwood, he cuts down the banana tree. As we know, the trunk of the banana tree is composed of several layers. Just as the formations aggregate is composed of many wholesome and unwholesome mental factors. This man peels away the layers of the tree, but he won't find even softwood, not to mention heartwood. This signifies that all mental formations are empty. There is no core and substance in them. The mental factor of mindfulness is empty of a self. The mental factor of wisdom is empty of a self. The mental factor of concentration is empty of a self. The mental factor of effort is empty of a self. And the mental factor of greed is empty of a self. There is no core in the formations aggregate. Knowing this, one will not identify any mental factor as an abiding self. The consciousness aggregate. The Buddha compared the consciousness aggregate to a magician. A magician can make something unreal appear as real and make us believe in it and delight in it. As a consequence of this, we delight in our thoughts, thinking that they are real. Therefore, consciousness or our mind always fools us. Just like the blind man who thought that the grimy cloth was a clean cloth, we think that the five aggregates are permanent and bring happiness and enjoyment. Thus, we are cheated by our mind. How should we contemplate that the five aggregates are insubstantial in order to remove the lust for the five aggregates? The answer can be found from Venerable Sariputta's reply to Mahakotita. Venerable Sariputta explained, The appropriate way a practitioner should attend to the five aggregates of clinging is to regard the five aggregates as impermanent, unsatisfactory, a disease, a cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction alien, a dissolution, empty, void, not a self. Should a practitioner attend in this way, it is possible for the practitioner to realize the fruit of a stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, and finally an arahant. As a practitioner attends to the five aggregates of clinging as impermanent, unsatisfactory, a disease, a cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction, alien, a dissolution, empty, void, not a self, he does not delight in the five aggregates, does not welcome them, does not remain holding on to them. As a consequence of this, delight in the five aggregates ceases. With the cessation of delight comes the cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging comes the cessation of existence. With the cessation of existence comes the cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair cease to be. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. The importance of right view. Chana Bhikkhu's dilemma. One day, Chana Bhikkhu was meditating. After emerging from seclusion, he went to the eldest monk and asked the eldest monk to preach the Dhamma to him. The eldest monk preached to him thus: form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, volitional formations are impermanent, and consciousness is impermanent. Moreover, the five aggregates are also non-self. It was a very short Dharma talk. Chana Bhikkhu bowed to the eldest monk and went back to his kuti. There he sat meditating. He thought to himself, I understand form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, volitional formations are impermanent, and consciousness is impermanent. I also understand they are not self. However, my mind does not understand the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisition, and the destruction of craving. My mind does not understand the cessation, the fading away, and nibbana. Instead, agitation and clinging arise in me, and my mind turns back. Who am I? Who am I? Who is myself sitting here meditating? And he thought that such a doubt would not have arisen in one who has seen the Dharma. He wondered, who can show me the path? Who can help me see the Dharma? Chana understood that the five aggregates are impermanent, and he also understood that the five aggregates are non-self. But why did such a doubt arise in him? Why did agitation and clinging arise in him? You may face the same problem. The commentary on this sutta states that doubt arose in Chana because his insight knowledge was very weak. Why was his insight knowledge weak? That was because before he proceeded to contemplate the impermanent and non-self nature of the five aggregates, he did not really discern cause and effect. He did not fully discern the conditional five aggregates. Due to the fact that he did not fully discern the conditional five aggregates, although he knew that the five aggregates are non-self, he still had doubt. Who am I? Who is myself? Who is this self sitting here meditating? This is why you first learn to discern nama-rupa, mind and matter, and cause and effect. Only then do you contemplate impermanence. If you do not contemplate cause and effect, but instead you go one step further to contemplate non-self, you will end up with Chana's dilemma. You will have doubt and perplexity about this self and about yourself. Although Chana understood the impermanent and non-self nature of the five aggregates, his mind did not understand the stilling of all formations and nibbana. Instead, agitation arose in him. This agitation arose in Chana because of fear of losing this self. For some meditators, finding no self but only the elements when practicing the four elements meditation, they weep with sorrow. That's because of fear. They are afraid of losing the self, which they have clung to so firmly and so strongly. Where does this fear come from? What is its cause? Such fear is caused by the clinging to self. Agitation and clinging, agitation out of fear and clinging to the self will block the meditator's progress. The mind will refuse to incline towards cessation or the stilling of all formations. Remembering this will be very helpful in your practice. You will come to this stage. In order to overcome the difficulty or dilemma of chana, you have to contemplate mind and matter, cause and effect, again and again. When you are able to contemplate cause and effect, the non-self nature will become clearer and clearer to you. You have already heard the four causes for the arising of materiality: karma, consciousness, nutriment, and temperament. You must not neglect the contemplation of cause and effect. This is known as second insight knowledge of discerning cause and effect. The views of eternalism and annihilationism. When this doubt and perplexity arose in chana, he thought Venerable Ananda might be able to help him. Ananda was praised by the Buddha for his wisdom and knowledge, and he listened to all the teachings of the Buddha. He approached Venerable Ananda and told him his difficulties. Ananda preached him a very profound sutta, the Kakayanagata Sutta. Venerable Ananda said, "This world, for the most part, relies on duality and polarity, upon the notion of existence and non-existence. For one who sees the origination of the world as it actually is with correct wisdom, the notion of non-existence will not occur in him. For one who sees the cessation of the world, the notion of existence will not occur in him." The notion of existence is the same as the view of eternalism. The notion of non-existence is the same as the view of annihilationism. In this world, most people get entangled in these dualities or views. Why does a person hold on or cling to the view of eternalism? That's because this person does not see the repeated cessation of formations. Therefore, during your Vipassana practice, it's essential to see the repeated passing away of formations to get rid of the view of eternalism. How did the view of annihilation come about? Why do people think that after death, everything is annihilated? That's because they did not see the arising or the origination of formations. Formations here signifies the world of conditions, sankhara. The five aggregates are the world of conditions. If a person does not see the origination, the formation, or the arising again and again of the five aggregates, then he will hold the view of annihilationism. The Buddha said the notion of non-existence will not occur in one who sees the origination of the five aggregates as they actually are with correct wisdom. Everything exists is one extreme. Nothing exists is another extreme. The Buddha avoided these two extremes and preached the middle way. Dependent on ignorance, karmic formations come to be. Dependent on karmic formations, consciousness comes to be. Dependent on consciousness, mind and matter come to be. Dependent on mind and matter, six sense bases come to be. Dependent on six sense bases, contact comes to be. Dependent on contact, feeling comes to be. Dependent on feeling, craving comes to be. Dependent on craving, clinging comes to be. Dependent on clinging, becoming or karmic activities come to be. Dependent on karmic activities, birth comes to be. Dependent on birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Thus arises the whole mass of suffering. This is the middle way. There is no person, no being, no he and no she, only cause and effect. When this exists, that comes to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. With the cessation of ignorance, karmic formations come to cessation. With the cessation of karmic formations, consciousness comes to cessation, etc. This ceases the whole mass of suffering. This is the middle path. This is the right view that can help you to avoid the view of eternalism and of annihilationism. When a meditator sees the five aggregates, whether materiality, feeling, perception, volitional formations, or consciousness, arising and passing away incessantly, he will not have a stand about myself. The view of myself will not occur to him. There's no perplexity and doubt. He realizes, what arises is suffering arising. What ceases is suffering ceasing. This knowledge is independent of others. It does not depend on the Buddha or on any teacher or a book. It is one's own practical insight. This is called right view. Discussion of right view can be connected to the Yamaka Sutta, where Bhikkhu Yamaka held a pernicious view, a wrong view. He said, as he understood the Dharma taught by the Blessed One, a bhikkhu whose taints are destroyed is annihilated and perishes with the breakup of the body and does not exist after death. His fellow monks tried to correct his wrong view, but in vain. Since nobody could convince Yamaka Bhikkhu, they finally invited Venerable Sariputta to talk to him. Out of compassion, Venerable Sariputta approached him and preached him the three universal characteristics of impermanence, suffering, and non-self of the five aggregates. Venerable Sariputta asked, "What do you think, friend Yamaka? Do you regard form as the Tathagata?" "No, friend," replied Bhikkhu Yamaka. "Do you regard feeling, perception, volitional formations, or consciousness as the Tathagata?" "No, friend." "What do you think, friend Yamaka? Do you regard the Tathagata as in form?" "No, friend." "Do you regard the Tathagata as apart from form?" "No, friend." "Do you regard the Tathagata as in feeling, as apart from feeling, as in perception, as apart from perception, as in volitional formations, as apart from volitional formations, as in consciousness, as apart from consciousness?" "No, friend." "What do you think, friend Yamaka? Do you regard form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness as the Tathagata?" "No, friend." "What do you think, friend Yamaka? Do you regard the Tathagata as one who is without form, without feeling, without perception, without volitional formations, without consciousness?" "No, friend." "But, friend, when the Tathagata is not apprehended by you as real and actual here in this very life, is it fitting for you to declare, 'As I understand the Dharma taught by the Blessed One, a bhikkhu whose taints are destroyed is annihilated and perishes with the breakup of the body and does not exist after death?'" "Formerly, friend Sariputta, when I was ignorant, I did hold that pernicious view. But now that I have heard this Dharma teaching of the Venerable Sariputta, I have abandoned that pernicious view and have made the breakthrough to the Dharma. If, friend Yamaka, they were to ask you, 'Friend Yamaka, when a bhikkhu is an arahant, one whose taints are destroyed, what happens to him with the breakup of the body after death?' Being thus asked, what would you answer?" You should try to answer this question yourself before getting the answer from Bhikkhu Yamaka, to see how much you have understood the Dharma correctly. If they were to ask me this, friend, I would answer thus. Friends, form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness are impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering ceases and passes away. When an arahant dies, if one says he is annihilated or the self has been destroyed, one has already assumed there was a self beforehand. Arahant is a conventional name for the five aggregates. The five aggregates are impermanent, and what is impermanent is suffering. Thus, when an arahant dies, we should conclude that what was suffering has ceased and passed away. The Buddha said that whatever arises is the arising of suffering. Whatever ceases is the cessation of suffering. Suffering exists, but no sufferer can be found. That's the essence of all the teachings of the Buddha. There is no person or being. We say a human being takes rebirth. This is only conventional truth. Who takes rebirth? Suffering takes rebirth. What is parinibbana? Final cessation? It is the cessation of suffering. This is the correct view. What to contemplate during meditation. We experience insight knowledge step by step. First, we discern mind and body, nama rupa. Although mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, is serenity practice, you can also discern nama rupa and cause and effect while practicing anapanasati. For example, the breath is composed of the four elements with the wind element as the predominant factor. This is materiality. The mind that knows the in and out breath is the consciousness aggregate. The perception perceives the breath. The feeling feels the breath. And the volitional formations act upon the breath. Here the meditator further examines thus. By what is respiration supported? He realizes supported by the basis, which is the coarse body. The coarse body is composed of the four great elements and the materiality derived from these. The coarse body is where the mental aggregates of feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness occur. The meditator examines the mind and the body and sees the causal relationship. He concludes that this mind and this body are bare conditions and things produced from conditions, and that besides these, there is neither a living being nor a person. We discern the same way while practicing the four elements meditation. While discerning the four elements, you may investigate the cause of arising of the four elements. Nothing can arise without a cause. If you investigate the mind, you will see that the very intention of seeing the four elements produces the four elements. For example, the intention to straighten up the crooked body produces the four elements with the wind element as the predominant factor, which pushes your body to become erect. Therefore, the mind is the cause and the four elements are the effect. Without discerning cause and effect, while seeing just the four elements without an entity, you might get frightened and fall prey to doubt, like Chana Bhikkhu. You might ask, if there is no self, who am I sitting here looking at the four elements? Your mind would get very agitated because of the fear of losing the self. Once the cause and effect are clearly discerned, one can proceed to contemplate the impermanence of physical and mental phenomena. Understanding suffering is not as easy as you might assume. You can only see suffering when you clearly and consistently see that phenomena are constantly subject to arising and ceasing. Before seeing this constant arising and passing away, it is very difficult to understand what suffering really means. You may understand suffering in terms of bodily or physical suffering only. This physical suffering is experienced by all human beings, and this type of suffering is not insight knowledge. It is not what the Buddha meant by suffering. The real insight knowledge into suffering comes from seeing repeatedly the arising and passing away of phenomena. At that time, you feel helpless or oppressed because this constant arising and passing away is beyond your control. With this experience, you come to understand the non-self nature of the mind and body. What is beyond our control, what does not yield to our wishes, is non-self. In the suttas, the Buddha constantly said, "What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering cannot be regarded as a self." When one sees impermanence, one sees suffering and non-self. Contemplating impermanence is the entry point to the arising of various kinds of insight knowledge. Hopefully, these explanations will help you establish right view. This right view, which is the forerunner of all wholesomeness, will help you along your spiritual path. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.